This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and my head is really swimming today with studies because I'm writing a chapter for a book on functional medicine, and they said, okay, your assignment is to write a chapter on the gastrointestinal system. So I'm piling up the resources and the studies and looking into this and trying to meld it with some of my experience of over 30 years in working with patients with GI problems like irritable bowel syndrome and GERD and ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And I wrote an introduction to this that talks about the importance of the microbiome. And we talk about that, set the stage for that discussion in part one. So if you haven't heard it, go back to part one. And there we talked about the impact of the microbiome on immunity. But let's now talk, let's turn our attention to the brain, okay? Because the gut-brain connection is now the subject of intense investigation. And in fact, one of my frequent guests and a doctor who I really admire, he's a good colleague of mine, I've known him for, well over 20 years, Dr. David Perlmutter, I've learned a lot from him, he's actually one of the founders of what's called the Gut-Brain Journal. There's going to be an entire, there's so much information about the relationship between the gut and the brain that it merits an entire medical journal, which is going to appear, every month or quarterly, stock, chock full of articles about different aspects of the gut-brain connection. And it's a two-way street. The brain obviously affects the gut because, stress can affect gastrointestinal function. In fact, it used to be thought irritable bowel syndrome was just a psychogenic disorder, just, stress-related. And it is to some extent, but there's many other things going on. It has to do with diet and dysbiosis. And, there's a lot more to it than just, you're anxious, so you have intestinal cramps and diarrhea or constipation. The brain also, stress, which is mediated through the experience of the brain, can actually change your microbiome. You can actually damage the balance of bacteria in your gut with constant stress. Conversely, it's a two-way street. What's happening in your gut doesn't stay in your gut. And there are certain factors that are made by bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract that may have a profound effect on the brain or on the central nervous system. So let's just go back to some real basics. So, one of the first things that I encountered in my medical training, because I trained in Manhattan VA Hospital, is we saw a lot of alcoholics. These were veterans, many of them poor and hard drinkers, and many of them had cirrhosis of the liver. And in cirrhosis of the liver, something very peculiar happens. You can sometimes develop a condition called hepatic encephalopathy. And the way that that presents is patients are delirious. They can't think straight. And they may even hallucinate. And they start to flap. Not like birds taken off, but their wrists start to tremor. And that's called flapping. Medical term for that's asterixis, if you're interested. And what's happening there is that the liver can no longer detoxify, because so much of the liver is destroyed, and toxins made in the gut build up, spill out of the gut, get into the systemic circulation. They got to travel through the bloodstream to the brain, and then they go into the brain, and they cause all these weird behaviors. Now, what's interesting, the way to treat it is to give the patients a laxative, which gets some of the junk out of their intestine, literally. They detox, and an antibiotic. The old-fashioned antibiotic was neomycin. Now they're using a newer one called Xifaxan, which is also used for SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. And in addition, the patients would get better. You just make them go to the bathroom, it'd kill off the bad bacteria, and they would calm down and be able to have normal brain function. So this is an amazing phenomenon. It's really a classic demonstration of gut toxicity, which, you know, maybe some of us are experiencing this on a lower level because it's not an all or nothing thing. You're either totally fine or you have asterixis and you need emergency treatment in a hospital. You know, maybe some of us are walking around with low grade gastro GI toxicity, which is causing us maybe not to be delirious, but maybe, you know, causing us brain fog or causing us some degree of mood alteration, discoordination, some degree of drunkenness, in effect. So what's interesting is that lately they've demonstrated that probiotics have been shown to prevent hepatic encephalopathy in cirrhotics. So you can, if you get to them before they develop the encephalopathy, you give them probiotics, they're less likely to develop the encephalopathy. The probiotics actually help to normalize the balance in their gastrointestinal tract, which affects their brains. It's amazing science. And it's very foundational for our understanding the relationship between the gut and the brain. Now, where does that lead us to? Well, they've actually done some research on the relationship between dysbiosis and neurodevelopmental disorders like autism. And one of the main hypotheses about autism, and there are multiple hypotheses, it's probably not one single cause, but children with autism definitely have different bacteria. And their dysbiosis may cause behavioral abnormalities, according to some papers that I've read. And so one of the therapies for kids is a diet change, the use of appropriate sources of fiber. What's interesting is there, you know, I have a diet that I often talk about in regard to inflammatory bowel syndrome, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Well, that diet, probably there are more people using that diet in autistic kids than for inflammatory bowel disease. Because the originator of that diet, Elaine Gottschall, discovered the diet because she had a child who had both ulcerative colitis and what was then called, many years ago, it was probably in the 50s, it was called infantile schizophrenia. Now, you no longer use that term because that term has been supplanted with the term autism. And so this child was having major gastrointestinal problems and also was experiencing real serious behavioral anomalies and was then placed on the specific carbohydrate diet, which is a lower carb diet, eliminating certain starches that promote bacterial overgrowth. And she averted having her colon removed because many doctors said that was the only answer in those days. And at the same time, normalized her behavior to the point where now she's a very successful, normal university professor. And there's a dramatic turnaround with the diet. So there's also evidence. And by the way, these authors say, you know, you could say, well, okay, these children with autism, they're stressed out. It's stressful to have autism. So maybe the presence of these unusual bacteria in the kids is not the cause of the autism, but it's the consequence of the autism. They said that their research suggests the opposite, that it's actually the bacterial anomalies are the cause, not the consequence of the behavioral disorders. So, okay, other conditions where the role of the microbiome may be important, Parkinson's disease, that's been demonstrated, Alzheimer's disease, depression and anxiety. In fact, clinical trials of probiotic administration have been demonstrated to impact mood. There's a really interesting study I came across 2015 from a journal called Brain Behavior Immunology. It's a randomized controlled trial to test the effect of multi-species probiotics on cognitive reactivity to sad mood. Okay? So, probiotics can make you have a better mood, according to studies. It's fascinating. And, you know, so from subtle psychological disorders like bad mood to serious and profound brain disorders like Alzheimer's disease, where, you know, clearly inflammation that starts in the gut may, you know, trigger a cascade of inflammatory events in the brain. You know, it's fascinating how pervasive these influences are. Okay, let's move on to the endocrine system, because the endocrine system, we're talking about the glands. We're talking about, well, we talk about the endocrine system, we talk about certainly insulin, which I'll come to a little later, because we'll put that under the category metabolism. But the endocrine system, you know, the thyroid, the adrenals, the sex hormones made by the testes and the ovaries. And the GI tract has many influences on endocrine function. So we already mentioned autoimmunity. And in patients who have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which results in hypothyroidism, it's the most common cause of hypothyroidism. It's caused by autoimmunity. And every single one of the patients that I see who have that, I urge them to get off of wheat, whether or not they have documented celiac disease, because even non-celiac gluten intolerance has been shown to trigger autoimmunity without necessarily triggering the characteristic changes in the villi of the gastrointestinal tract, which are the hallmark for celiac disease. They're kind of stingy about handing out diagnoses of celiac disease. They want to do an intestinal biopsy. And if that's not abnormal, they say, well, you don't worry about it. Eat as much wheat as you want. Well, I say there are more subtle forms of this. It's often missed. And many patients with autoimmunity get a heck of a lot better when they get off of gluten. So moreover, and think about this. When you have a thyroid problem, your gastrointestinal tract slows down. It's often associated with constipation. And the result of that is that changes your intestinal balance. And we know that slowed intestinal transit can contribute to SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. So in patients who have SIBO, we often look for underlying thyroid problems as both a cause and a consequence of the SIBO. And then you get kind of a vicious cycle, like the thyroid is weak, the gastrointestinal tract slows down, dysbiosis or bacterial overgrowth occurs, the thyroid is further damaged by autoimmunity, and it's a downhill vicious cycle. So also, let's look at estrogen and testosterone. They are actually broken down and metabolized by bacteria in your gastrointestinal tract. So what are the consequences of excess estrogen? Excess estrogen can lead to fibroids. It can lead to menstrual abnormalities. It can lead to what we call estrogen dominance, which encourages fat deposition and may have mood effects. But also, you know, all that excess estrogen that's unmetabolized can increase your risk for uterine cancer or breast cancer in women. And in men, there's some thought that estrogenic effects may damage the prostate. Yet it's not just too much estrogen, it's maybe the wrong estrogens, estrogens that aren't properly conjugated or broken down or detoxified or harmlessly taken out of the body by the action of an efficient, normal microbiome. So, you know, I've read an article, just went page after page after page of the implications of the gastrointestinal microbiome on hormones. And even growth hormone, let's think about this, you know, okay, growth hormone is what is responsible for us to grow and repair. But you know, it used to be thought that kids who have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis are often short, and sometimes a growth delay in a kid, it's a good idea to do a workup to make sure they don't have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease that's not apparent. And you know, I've actually sent some kids to the gastroenterologist, failure to thrive, and it's turned out they've had not obvious, they're not bleeding from the rectum, but they do have some stomach problems. Turns out they have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. Well, it turns out that certain lipopolysaccharides, which are toxins made by bacteria, have been shown to inhibit growth hormone. And that may account, in part at least, for the growth retardation that's seen in children with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And oh, by the way, the treatment for that is you go to a pediatric endocrinologist, your kid's got failure to thrive, and you get growth hormone shots to replace the growth hormone that's not being made. It's even thought that the microbiome has an effect on skeletal fitness because it impacts several things that have an effect on bones. The reproductive hormones obviously do, parathyroid hormones, glucocorticoids, serotonin, and the cytokines may provoke inflammation in the bones just as they do in other parts of the body, so that osteoporosis may be an autoimmune disease. So finally, let's talk about metabolism, because you know the saying, it's not your fault, you're fat. It may, you know, blame your microbiome. They've done remarkable experiments that show that you can transfer obesity from a fat rat to a thin rat via an inoculation of feces. You take, you know, a fecal sample from the fat rat, give it to the thin rat, and the thin rat grows fat. And the converse also occurs when flora from lean animals are transferred to fat animals. So you can actually, maybe this is a, you know, this is a little bit of a far out remedy. Please don't try this at home for obesity. And another evidence of this is that they is now authorized and medically approved to use fecal transplants for treatment of C. difficile infection, which is a terrible infection that's no longer responsive sometimes to antibiotics. That's the initial therapy, but doesn't go away. It's a very, very difficult infection to eradicate. And fecal transfer is very effective at normalizing this condition. But in a few cases, what they get the feces from, quote, healthy donors that are not infected with HIV or, you know, viruses. They made the mistake in some of the early trials of not screening for obesity. And some of these patients with terrible diarrhea who were wasting away, the opposite happened to them. They were healed of their C. difficile infections. They normalized their bowel function. But then they found it really hard to maintain optimal weight. They started to gain weight to the point where they were threatened with obesity. And actually, this is anecdotal. You got to maybe look this up to confirm it. But I think that there's actually a malpractice case that's based on improper screening of a donor. You gave me the stool from a fat donor, and now you've made me into a fatty. And, you know, I'm calling my lawyer. Okay. There's also in gastric bypass, you know, it was thought that in gastric bypass, you know, one of the reasons you lose weight is because literally you got a smaller stomach. Okay. It's like called stomach stapling. And that's part of it. But also, you know, you cut out a part of your absorptive surface, and that means you're going to absorb less nutrients, less calories, and you lose weight. But actually, some studies show that the weight loss may be attributable to a change in the flora of the gastrointestinal tract that is induced by changing the structure of the gastrointestinal tract. And how they prove that is they did the typical kind of gastric surgery on that they do on humans, you know, gastric bypass surgery on rats. And then they took the intestinal contents of these rats they did surgery on, and they took it out, and then they administered it to overweight rats without doing surgery on them, and they lost weight. So it was actually the bacteria mediated the weight loss effect. It was quite fascinating. How does that happen? How does the microbiome have an influence on metabolism? Well, for one, the extraction of nutrients may be dependent on the composition of the microbiome, so that certain bacteria may be more efficient at breaking down food and converting it into nutrients for you. And others other bacteria may actually feed on the nutrients and transform them into non-nutritive substances that don't make you gain weight. For another reason that the microbiome may determine weight, the byproducts of the bacterial breakdown of nutrients may signal regulatory pathways. For example, trigger insulin resistance. I mean, these are very complex pathways. Or they may signal satiety, you know, making you feel full more easily. These are breakdown products of the foods that you eat, and in the presence of certain bacteria, you may get more or less satiety, or you may get more or less insulin signaling, which can result in insulin resistance. And then, you know, there's God knows how many hormones in the gastrointestinal tract, you know, vasoactive intestinal peptide and, you know, CCK and all these things that kind of slosh around in there. Leptin, of course, adiponectin, all these things that determine, you know, whether you're going to eat or whether you're going to get fat. And bacteria actually have an impact on that equation. And finally, certain bacteria may promote inflammation, which is a known contributor to metabolic syndrome. Inflammation gums up the works of insulin metabolism and helps to perpetuate weight gain. I've seen it again and again. My patients who are inflamed, who have inflammatory disorders, they simply can't lose weight, even with stringent diets. A bit of a tour of the ways in which the microbiome can affect health. I'm sure I've missed a multiplicity of ways and pathways in which health can be impacted by the microbiome, but I thought I'd give you a so basic 20,000-foot overview of this. You know, the relationship of the microbiome to metabolism is so considered now so important that National Institute of Health funds were recently authorized for a study to see if the microbiome is linked to diabetes risk in Hispanic Americans. And guess where that research is being done? It's been done at my alma mater, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And, you know, of course, Hispanic Americans is the population that has seen obesity rates skyrocket, secondary to cultural changes. If you think about it, you know, you go down to these countries where, you know, it hasn't really been westernized, where some of these people originate from, and they're slim, trim individuals. Same thing with Native Americans in the historical past, but not in modern times. And then they get introduced, they come to America, they get introduced to a Western diet, a Western lifestyle, maybe get Western medicines, Western birthing practices, you know, have more, less exposure to dirt, and the hygiene hypothesis kicks in, and their microbiome gets changed. And, you know, maybe it's not simply that they're more sedentary and they eat more calories. You know, that's sort of the thermodynamic theory, calories in, calories out. Well, certainly that plays a role, but maybe some of this is mediated by alterations in the microbiome. So bottom line, you know, take good care of your microbiome, eat a healthy diet, get plenty of fiber, eat foods that are fermented, live bacteria from, if you're tolerant to dairy, healthy yogurts, but also things like kimchi and sauerkraut that's not pasteurized. Take a good probiotic if you're raising kids, raise them the right way to have a healthy microbiome. Rely less on medications like acid blockers, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that you take for pain may have an impact also on the intestinal tract. Virtually all processed foods have negative impact. So there you have it. I mean, there's some ways to nourish a healthy microbiome and even recover after your microbiome has been damaged. And then in so many ways, your health will be benefited. I want to thank you for listening. I know the subject is challenging, but I think it's a great interest, and it really is one of the central ways in which I visualize patients and do problem solving when I see challenging cases. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.